Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Key West, Florida sounds like good times. Sun, beach, palm trees, happy hour, history. It's drawn a stream of American artists over time, from Ernest Hemingway to Tennessee Williams, Tom McGuane to Hunter S. Thompson. Then there's Jimmy Buffett, who took the island lifestyle and transformed it into a musical empire. There's a story about artists in Key West and its time as a bohemian utopia. My guest today tells it. This hour on Point, wild, sun-soaked, drug-addled, inspirational Key West. Joining me now in the studio is William McKean, professor and chair of the journalism department at Boston University. Author of many books, including Outlaw Journalist, The Life and Times of Hunter S. Thompson. His latest is Mile Marker Zero, The Movable Feast of Key West. William McKean, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Will you come with me just for a minute, straight
sure.
to the man himself, Mr. Key West, at least for about a decade of his life. Here's a recording made around 1938, Ernest Hemingway, and he talks here about his favorite places to write. Key West, not alone, but it's right in the middle of it. Here's Ernest Hemingway, 38.
It was always a good place for working. So was Paris, and so were Key West, Florida in the cool months. The ranch near Cook City, Montana, Kansas City, Chicago, Toronto, and Havana, Cuba. Some other places were not so good, but maybe we were not so good when we were in them.
But maybe we were not so good when we were in them. Hemingway, talking like Hemingway, sounds almost like the send-up, and yet he was it. He set the template for artists, the whole crew of artists you described as drawn to Key West. When was he there? What was the template he set? What was the kind of image and symbolism that Ernest Hemingway set around this little island, 2 miles by 4 miles, 90 miles from Cuba?
Well, he arrived at the late 20s and was just passing through town and ended up staying for a decade, more or less, off and on. And what he did was he did create this template for the macho American writer, sort of the literary He-Man type. And it persisted, you know, may even persist in some ways till today. But certainly in the 70s, the era that I'm writing about in the book, Hemingway cast a very long shadow over generations of writers, for good or for ill, but they all wanted to be like him, dress like him, look like him, and of course that meant going to Key West. That had to be on your itinerary.
Sloppy Joe's and Captain Tony's and drinking in the sunset and all the rest. Take us way back for just a second. We'll come to now, and then we'll get back to the decade you're really having your sights here, which is the 1970s, very particular time. But you've got these great descriptions of Key West way back in the day when it was port and cigar center and the kind of recitation of Spanish poetry and Shakespeare and all the rest that went on?
It was a city, that a little town that had to invent itself again and again, and it was a cigar haven for a while. It was sort of established as a place for the American wrecking industry, which is where pirates, legalized pirates, would go to wreck ships and loot them and then sell the goods ashore.
It was sort of pirate's flea market.
Right.
There.
Free enterprise pirates, yeah, I like to call them.
Yes.
So it was. It had so many parts of its history. I do like that era in the 1880s when it was a cigar rolling haven, and the Cuban cigar rollers learned English by having actors read to them in the cigar rolling room. So they'd read Dickens and so forth. They really, really liked English authors a great deal.
The opening up of Key West was all about transportation. I mean, Hemingway came there when it was still, I guess, sort of puddle-jumping boats
right
down to Key West. But remind us what happened. The big railway came in with Flagler, the great developer of Florida, and what happened and when that sort of blew it open?
Flagler kept wanting a nice resort that was free from bad weather, so he built a resort in St. Augustine, and then that got a little too cold, so he went to Ormond Beach, which is near Daytona. He worked his way down to build the breakers in Palm Beach and finally decided, oh, what the hell, and built this gigantic hotel in Key West called the Casa Marina.
At the end of a railway that came right down through those Keys, what is nearly 100 miles of Keys,
right,
and come all the way. That is a long, that's really the tip end of America.
Right.
But he did it, and then in 1935 or so?
Right. It was destroyed in a hurricane, and so it was rebuilt by President Roosevelt as the overseas highway. And so it was connected by street by road eventually. The old rail bridge is still there.
For the first time, the railroad blown away. Roosevelt comes in, builds a highway all the way to Key West. There had already been, and I guess during this time came, this drip of literary figures down there. You write Robert Frost and Wallace Stevens.
Stephen Crane. I mean, it starts early. Robert Frost wrote a letter about how he didn't much care for Key West, but it would do. It would last. It was better than anything else that was going on at the time. But I think the person that really established it as this literary haven was Hemingway.
What took Hemingway there and all the rest? Was it? Did they have a map in mind? Did they want to go to that furthest point, sort of as far out on the edge of America as you could get within the continent?
I think that became part of the appeal of the town, but he arrived on his way back to Arkansas. He had just gotten married, and his wife was pregnant, and she wanted to go home to the bosom of her family in Arkansas to have the baby. And they had sailed back from Europe after his decade in Paris. And he spent an afternoon there. He was supposed to pick up a car. Car wasn't ready, so he walked around the town and fell in love. And that very day that he got there, checked into an apartment, and began working on A Farewell to Arms.
You've got a little reading, I think, for us from Ernest Hemingway from To Have and Have Not, 1937 novel, about a boat captain who smuggles contraband between Cuba and Florida. And I think you've got a passage, Bill, where Ernest Hemingway describes Key West.
Certainly. He did not take the bicycle, but walked down the street. The moon was up now, and the trees were dark against it. And he passed the frame houses with their narrow yards, light coming from the shuttered windows, the unpaved alleys with their double rows of houses, Conktown, where all was starched, well-shuttered, virtue, failure, grits and boil grunts, undernourishment, prejudice, righteousness, interbreeding, and the comforts of religion, the open-doored, lighted Cuban bolito houses, shacks whose only romance was their names, the Red House, Chichicas, the pressed stone church, its steeple sharp, ugly triangles against the moonlight, the big grounds and the long, black-domed bulk of the convent, handsome in the moonlight, a filling station and a sandwich place, bright lighted beside a vacant lot where a miniature golf course had taken out. Past the brightly lit main street with the three drug stores, the music store, three pool rooms, two barbershops, five beer joints, three ice cream parlors, the five poor and the one good restaurant, two magazine and paper places, four secondhand joints, one of which made keys, a photographer's, an office building with four dentist offices upstairs, the big dime store, a hotel on the corner with taxis opposite, and across, behind the hotel, the big unpainted frame house with lights and girls in the doorway, the mechanical piano going, and a sailor sitting in the street. And then on back, past the back of the brick courthouse with its clock luminous at 10:30, past the whitewashed jail building shining in the moonlight, to the embowered entrance of Lilac Time, where motor cars fill the alley.
William McKean, reading from Ernest Hemingway, 1937, To Have and Have Not. He's writing about the whole Key West literary scene, really the 1970s, in his new book, Mile Marker Zero, The Movable Feast of Key West. I should say there's an excerpt at our website you can read. It's pretty fun to dive into, onpointradio.org. So here's Hemingway. He's looking at the starchy side of town for a minute here. Righteousness, interbreeding, and the comforts of religion. That's a long way from the decade you describe. Let's bring it right up to date first, though, so we can just bookend this, and then we'll dive into the 70s. I mean, you right now, that today, everybody talks about the Disneyfication of Key West, and the residents today, you write, fall into one of two groups, millionaires or homeless with hardly any in between. Paint the picture of Key West today, and then we'll get to your decade.
A lot of the middle class has been priced out of Key West, and so the people that work in the service industry who work at the restaurants and the T-shirt shops and so forth live up the keys in Big Pine or Sugarloaf Key or Cudjoe Key, and they commute. And that real estate just went crazy in Key West, and I think if you were an old line family, an old line conch family, had been there for a while, if you paid off your mortgage, you were okay. But if you weren't, it was just became impossible to buy a house there. And so there is a kind of this split, and you do see some homeless people, freelance residents of Paradise, they call themselves. And I don't know. I've never been to a community where you could see that disparity so clearly.
The little town, you write, has in some ways been embalmed as an alcoholic theme park. In the last third of the 20th century, William McKean writes, the state of Florida excelled in killing off that which was authentic and recreating it as something sterile and animatronic. Where once the state had genuine wildness, Disney backhoes tore up the work of nature. And so with Key West, new construction mimicking old, incredible simulation. But in other ways, the town remains what it has always been, the little village at the end of the road, and absolutely the end of the road. When you say mile marker zero, that's what you mean. That's where the highway begins.
That's where the road ends, too.
Yes.
Goes both ways.
The beginning and the ending. We're going to come back and dive into this decade of the 70s where Tom McGuane and a whole lot more made a whole lot of fun and mischief and art in Key West. Hunter Thompson's in there, and Jim Harrison, Peter Fonda shows up, Margot Kidder. William McKean breaks it all open in his book, Mile Marker Zero. Here's, of course, Jimmy Buffett. We'll talk about the empire he built out of the Key West vibe with I Found Me a Home, 1973. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
When you're coming off a cold love that shook, a nice warm touch. Yes, I have found me a home. I have found me a home. You can have the rest of everything I own, 'cause I have found me a home.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about America's wild tropical retreat, high times and unfettered artists in Key West, Florida. Jimmy Buffett made an industry out of it. Here's a 2000 interview where Jimmy Buffett, describes the process of briefly re-immersing himself in Key West culture. He's got a place in St. Bart's now, but re-immersing himself in Key West with friends in preparation for releasing what was a compilation of old music videos.
I went to the bars where we actually drank, and what we actually came up with in retrospect is probably an incredible history of Key West in the 70s, the people and the places. Key West has been and always will be a town in the middle of the hurricane center, and you never know who's going to blow through.
You never know who's going to blow through. Jimmy Buffett, who's turned it into a multi-million dollar business. Today we've got Hemingway at the back, Papa Hemingway. At this end of it, you've got, the Disneyfication and Millionaires and Homeless, as you write, William McKean. But take us to this decade, the 1970s, and what it was in particular that was drawing a generation of writers in particular to Key West then.
Well, at first it was the fishing. The central character of the book is Thomas McGuane, who was sort of dubbed the new Hemingway. And so it was inevitable that he'd go to Key West. But he described himself as an old hippie, and a lot of these guys were probably, you know, in that category. And they had all these ideals that
not so old then.
Well, no, but now he calls himself an old hippie.
Yeah.
But I think they had all these ideals that they had sort of forged in the 60s. And, you know, after the Democratic Convention in 1968 and the police riot and after Altamont and all these other apocalyptic things at the end of that decade, I think they went to Key West consciously to try and see if they could make those dreams work. As I said, they were sort of test driving the ideals, and they were trying to create this sort of different society, a freer, open, certainly artist-friendly society. And, of course, along the way, they drank a lot and had a lot of drugs, but they also had a lot of fun, too.
You're right. The community was attracting a lot of young people who were dissatisfied with the country and its status quo. Some came because they were disillusioned, heartbroken, or world-weary. Lots of war, lots of assassinations, and all the rest in the 60s. Key West was a hideaway for others, but there were also those who saw Key West as the place to experiment with their lives or their art. The lure of a no-holds-barred society on a rock in the blue water of the Caribbean was intoxicating, and had been for a while. I mean, there was this live-and-let-live ethos on Key West that brought Tennessee Williams, among others. There was a gay population here. I mean, it wasn't so easy for him in his time, but still.
No, it wasn't, and Tennessee Williams is a very important figure. He had moved there after a failure on Broadway in 1941 and sort of set up a home there. And that was a place where he could be the way he wanted to be. He could have the kind of life he wanted to have. And he was a beloved figure around town, which didn't mean that he was embraced from the start. I think he had a lot of struggles because of his sexuality that...
Even in Live and Let Live Key West.
Even Live and Let Live Key West. Mm-hmm. I think there were some issues. But I think he kind of made it a safe haven.
So what was this scene? Well, I mean, Jimmy Buffett had come down. He'd grown up, I think, in Alabama, Mobile.
Correct.
Or somewhere.
Right.
Singer had been, as I recall, it was busking in Nashville and New Orleans, hooked up with Jerry Jeff Walker, who took him down to Key West maybe for the first time in 1970, 71?
Right. He went to visit Jerry Jeff Walker, and he was going to try and get a gig at a little nightclub in Miami because it was, you know, the middle of winter. And he showed up 2 weeks early by accident. And so Jerry Jeff's girlfriend said, well, what the heck? Let's go to Key West. So they took him to Key West. They stopped at every bar on the way down from Alabama Jack's and Key Largo all the way down to the No Name Bar on No Name Key, and got him there in time for sunset that night, and then took him to the chart room, and he drank for free. I mean, he said that was the best thing about it, free beer. And within just a matter of weeks, I think he had decided, this is where I want to live, this is my art, this is what I'm going to do. And he tried to take that attitude, the Key West attitude, and set it to music. And that is Jimmy Buffett's career.
And Parrot Heads and an industry that right. he built out of it. We'll follow that arc, but there was a very different arc here of artists who were following their muse through Key West. It didn't all end up with great success. There was some crashing and burning going on here. Hunter S. Thompson comes right into the middle of it. There was also a very important population of women in here that you describe, and some of them dealing with these guys who were still sort of 50s men with that Hemingway image in their minds. Suddenly encountering 60s women in Key West and a kind of tension there.
That is one of the more interesting conflicts, I think, in the book, is between the generation of Thomas McGuane and Jim Harris and these literary He-Man types who were, as Margot Kidder called them, 50s men. Well, Margot Kidder fell into this. She was, of course,
Margot Kidder, the actress who was in all the Superman movies with Superman.
Sort of the hot young actress of her time, making all these great films. Mm-hmm. She fell in love with McGuane, moved to Key West to make a movie with him. And she said there was a real problem here because here were these 50s girls who, you know, just didn't have any luck with women when they were growing up. And so now they're going around strutting for each other.
50s guys, yeah.
Yeah, 50s yeah. guys, sorry. And then she was a 60s woman, and she said, we were really different. And so there's kind of a gender clash, a generational clash going on between them.
Jim Harrison was right in the middle of it, not as well known as Tom McGuane, but he was a real force. Sort of, everybody in those days seems to have been compared, if they were hot, to Faulkner or Hemingway.
Right.
McGuane was, Harrison was. He writes a little bit about here, which gives you that sort of macho, out on the seas, get the booze and get the fish feeling from A Good Day to Die? Is that
correct?
What we got? Can you read a little bit of that for us? This is another sort of out of Key West voice from the decade.
Double anchored off Cudjoe Key, barely dawn and she's still asleep, but I was awakened by waterbirds. So many. The first sight upward from the skiff's bottom was an osprey with a small snake hanging from her talons. Back to the nest now in the rookery for breakfast. Almost chilly in the mid-60s at 6 a.m., but it will be 80 by noon. I wanted to get over to the Snipe Key Basin and catch the incoming tide and what fish would be there, looking off that huge sandspit toward the rank mangroves. She's snoring. When she said she'd never sleep at the boat's bottom, it was too hard and had no air mattresses. Drone of a sponger off to work. How they stand in that narrow prow without falling off, it must be genetic. I talked to one for a half hour once and understood nothing. She's waking. Lukewarm coffee in her thermos. The mosquitoes were bad in the night, and sand fleas. Over the freeboard, I see a small sand shark nuzzling around the prongs of the sea anchor. Let's go back, she says. I thought you wanted to fish. That was the margaritas you gave me. I thought for a moment of kicking her out of the boat, but that would be murder. We were sweating like piggies in that sleeping bag, and I thought how in youth I had heard about our soldiers in the Orient getting rolled up in rugs with Chinese girls. Too hot, and we didn't manage. After coming out at dusk with the markers and not totally visible, only a drunk or a master would try to steal it, and I was the former. I stood on the freeboard and cast a steamer, but a barracuda sniped the leader when it struck.
William McKean reading from Jim Harrison's A Good Day to Die, and you've got our soldiers in the Orient, Vietnam, the Vietnam War behind all of this.
Right.
We'll look at that. Hemingway, you can just hear him echoing still right through the mosquitoes were bad in the night and sand fleas. But here's this macho guy. It's all talons and reefs and incoming
right.
tide and rank mangroves and, you know, girls in rolled up in carpets.
You know, now Harrison and McGuane are these grand old men of American letters, and they sort of look back on this period and sort of shrug and say, well, you know, it was hard to escape a Hemingway influence. But this was Jim Harrison when he was still living hand-to-mouth and he hadn't yet written Legends of the Fall and made his big money.
Legends of the Fall, of course, the Brad Pitt movie out of Montana,
right.
where many people in here have this other foot. Tom McGuane. Let's hear him. Here he is in 1986 talking about how much Key West had changed since his days there, the days you described, the days of the 70s, described in Mile Marker Zero. Here's Thomas McGuane.
It has changed vastly since when I, believe it or not, since I lived there, which is not all that many years ago. I remember I was looking in the Bushwhack Piano a while ago. It's just been reissued by Vintage Books, and I read this description of this old octagonal house that was around the corner from me, and there was an old lady that lived on the second floor of it, used to watch the people walking by in the streets, and she'd been there apparently since the turn of the century. And it suddenly dawned on me, oh yeah, that's Calvin Klein's house. So, and in the sense, and that, I wrote that in 1973, it seemed a permanent part of the Key West landscape.
Literature, celebrity, literary celebrity. I mean, this is Tom McGuane, who back in the day, 31 years old, in the New York Times, calls him a talent of Faulknerian potential. Saul Bellow describes him as a language star. And pretty soon, though, this is anything but sort of a pure island life. I mean, everybody's just racked up in cocaine and fancy cars if they can afford them, and multiple marriages and, you know, sex every which way. I mean, this is some scene. Did they feel debauched or like they were looking for utopia or both?
Oh, geez, I don't know. But Tom McGuane was a little like a literary Boo Radley, in that his friends would come visit, like Jim Harrison and Russell Chatham, the painter. They'd want to go out partying, and Tom was so serious and intent on his work. He would get up at 6 in the morning, and if he wasn't fishing, he'd be writing, and he just didn't do anything. And then one day, it just clicked. And he went out and became, as he called himself, Captain Berserko, the king of nocturnal pain. And he became one of the most notorious drug and alcohol abusers of his generation. And then remarkably just gave that up after several years of craziness, just gave it up and walked away and is clean and sober for 35 years.
But those are the years, those Captain Berserko years that you've got right at the heart of this. And people were drawn. I mean, when Hunter S. Thompson shows up, you know you've got Captain, you got Mr. Gonzo and Captain Berserko going on at the same time.
You know, McGuane was such an inspiration to Thompson, and he wrote a really great book about Key West called 92 in the Shade, which is sort of the central story.
McGuane's book about two fishing captains or guides.
Fishing guides at war, which doesn't sound like a great parable for the 60s, but I think that's what it was. Apparently, Thompson felt so highly of that book that he had it engraved on a nameplate and put on his office chair, 92 in the Shade.
92 in the Shade. Sounds like one he'd go for.
Yeah.
William McKean is with us. His book is Mile Marker Zero, The Movable Feast of Key West. Let's go to our callers. James in Nashville, Tennessee. You're on the air. Thanks for calling, James.
Hi there, Tom. How you doing?
Pretty well. What do you know, James?
Well, you know, it's funny. It's a great show. A friend of mine called me and said, you need to listen to this show because it's all about Key West. And I just got back from Key West 2 days ago. I'm a songwriter in Nashville, Tennessee, who just got back from doing a video down there about 2 days ago, and I spent a lot of time down in Key West. I divide my time between Nashville and Key West, actually.
So what do you see there now? Can you feel all these great ghosts of the literary folks past with the, you know, the straw on the nose and all the rest, or is it different?
Oh, yeah. No. Hemingway's ghost is all over the island. You have Jimmy Buffett's ghost. You've got Hemingway. You've got Tennessee Williams. A little bit of Castro, Che Guevara, all mixed in one. And, you know, every year in around April, there's about 100 of the top songwriters in the country come from Nashville and make a pilgrimage to Key West for the Key West Songwriter Festival.
Has it still got the funk, though, really, James? Has it got it, or does it feel Disney-fied up and, you know, paved over?
You know what? It's still got the funk. You just have to get into the back alleys and the little bars and the... And ride your bike, you know, ride your bike at about 2 in the morning. You still got the edge down there, trust me. It's as beautiful as it ever was. It's changed a little bit, but, you know, it's still, you just got to get in the back alleys, get a little dirty down there.
James, I appreciate your call. Still feeling it, still flocking down at least once a year. Let me get one more right here. Leslie from New Haven, Connecticut. Leslie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I had a question. My husband is Cuban, and his parents live in Homestead, not far from the Keys. And mm-hmm. I keep hearing about how significant Key West was to Cubans, but this seemed like it was in the 50s. And I remember when we were down there seeing the Pan American sign of where, you know, the airline used to be. And I just wondered, you know, if they still feel that influence down in Key West, or if it's just been, you know, absorbed into the culture now, and it's not noticeable.
It's a great question. I mean, you can never help noticing. The big signs are all there, 90 miles to Cuba. back in the day in the 70s, Cuba was a universe away. I mean, we were still coming, you know, it was missile crisis was still echoing and all the rest. What about the Cuban influence presence now?
It's still a strong influence. My in-laws are Cuban, and they live in Key West. And it's just part of the culture there. I know that the other side of my wife's family that lived there would used to fly to Havana for lunch.
Back in the
50s. Mm-hmm. But you can't escape the... I know, isn't that...
That's
be fun?
Unbelievable.
You can't escape the Cuban influence there. It's one of the things that makes Key West so beautiful. And what the earlier caller said is right. I started going to the Keys when I was a kid because I lived in South Florida for a few years. Went every weekend to go fishing. And then when I came back as an adult and you saw the development, and you decry this and you lament that, the McDonald's here and there. At the same time, though, the Keys are still the Keys, and Key West is still Key West, you know, despite the faults, despite the development. The authenticity and the beauty of the town and the people still comes through.
But you're married to a Key Wester, and she, and not alone in this, wanted to get out of there.
Well, I think that she felt that she needed to see more of the world after having grown up there, and had never lived out of Florida until this past year, and spent a lot of her life in North Florida. But to me, I don't know if I could ever live there full time because I would be claustrophobic. It's 2 miles by 4 miles wide, and I'm a big guy. I need more space. But she was, you know, there's so many things about Key West to love, but I think it was also a good thing to get away from there. As Jimmy Buffett made the decision to move because he was beginning to have children, and they thought that wasn't a good place to raise children.
Did the artists who went feel like they found that vantage on America that they were looking for? Something, you know, some distance so they could look back at the mainland? Or did they just get lost in the music of the island itself?
You know, if it was just the island life, if it was just the tropics that was the attraction, then they might have moved to, you know, elsewhere in the Caribbean on non-American soil. But McGuane insisted on staying in Key West because he said, I need to stay connected to this culture and this country that I know. This is my subject, this country. So it's American, even though it's awfully weird and foreign.
We're talking this hour about Key West and the literary life that grew there, what, early in the last century. By the 1970s, it was in full blossom, sometimes lurid blossom. We'll talk about Hunter S. Thompson and his time there when we come back. William McKean's new book is Mile Marker Zero, The Movable Feast of Key West. John Mellencamp singing Key West Intermezzo not so long ago, 1996 album, Mr. Happy-Go-Lucky. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
You just made that story up. There ain't no girl like that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's wild tropical retreat, at least it was, high times and unfettered artists in Key West, Florida. The sound of a street performer, busker behind me right there, playing and singing in Key West's Mallory Square not so long ago. My guest today is William McKean. He takes us back to the roaring decade of the 1970s. Sex, drugs, rock and roll, wife swapping, you've got it all in Mile Marker Zero, The Movable Feast of Key West. And in the middle of that, a whole lot of artists and writers looking for a place at the edge of a country that was in all kinds of disrepair in those days, on the backside of assassination, still in the thick of the Vietnam War. Bill McKean, you remind us of something, only like 20,000 had died in Vietnam at that point, and it would go to 50,000 just in the next few years. Tom McGuane's 92 in the Shade was big in 1975, came out in film, written and directed by McGuane, tells the story of two feuding fishing guides in Key West, played by Warren Oates and Peter Fonda. Here, Oates' character threatens Fonda's not to move in on his territory.
You're always on the damn flats out there in front of me.
Yes, sir, I'm kind of studying you.
I wonder how come. Uninvited and all.
Well, I enjoy water sports.
Very good. but I wouldn't really recommend it.
But I wasn't applying for recommendations.
You don't follow me. I am suggesting how unattractive a day on the open water can get.
Machismo on the Fishing Flats there, 92 in the shade, and Pistoles come out before it's all over. Greg in Charleston, South Carolina is calling. Greg, you're on the air with Bill McKean. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom, thanks. I really just wanted to sort of shine a light on David Allan Coe. A lot of people don't know, but he's a great singer-songwriter that a lot of people just associate with Nashville and country, but he lived in Key West even at a point when Jimmy Buffett had moved away. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize it, but he was one of the best songwriters, in my opinion, in the country music field. And, you know, he had a connection to Key West for a long time and still lives there, I believe.
Also with a line in Key West. Bill McKean, did you catch up with David Allan Coe in your research?
No, I didn't, but I agree with him about David Allan Coe's abilities. There's also Keith Sykes, another great country singer-songwriter who was there. There's so many artists and writers there. I sort of had to, I was focusing on this one group, the Hemingway influence of on McGuane and Harrison, but there's also Shel Silverstein, who wrote all those great books, lived at Key West. In fact, my wife knew him. He used to be a regular customer at her restaurant. So when I was down there doing research on the book last year, I went out to dinner the first night, and there were four best-selling novelists in the restaurant. So, I mean, you can't move without bumping into somebody.
It's still got that cachet, that allure, even now with sort of Disney in the air. Michael in Lexington, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi there, Tom. Actually, I met you on the Charles River past spring when you were there with Rob Young. Okay, I was there in 1977, Key West, having come back from 6 months in India, Nepal, and I had certainly one of the most remarkable times of my life. It was so great, essentially hedonistically, that I had to leave because it was too much. and from the cold tundra of Massachusetts and Boston to get into this wondrous, sensuous environment there, which really was a fantastic catalyst for well-being. And it was totally remarkable. I had almost forgotten about it until happenstance to be listening to the show. So it's a wonderful memory, and it was just fantastic.
Hey, Michael, let me ask you about it, Michael, if I may. I mean, it's wonderful just to listen to you, the way it comes back. It's luscious even now, but then, you know, you're saying it's a fantastic catalyst for well-being, but it's also so hedonistic you had to leave.
Well, all I mean was I had enough. It was so remarkable having come from the kind of the cerebral intellectual environment of Boston, where that energy isn't really omnipresent. And it was just such a wondrous infusion that it was time to let it go in a healthy way. So I have to admire myself that I actually even left.
and Michael, and congratulations. It sounded like you got out at just the right time and had fun before you did. I appreciate your call. Bill, what about this tension? I mean, here you've got so hedonistic, you got to get out of there or it'll drown you. On the other hand, in Michael's wonderful phrase, a fantastic catalyst for well-being.
Whoa. Yeah, that's interesting. It sounds like he enjoyed as much of it as he could stand. But that's kind of the experience that my characters had in the book, in that they didn't know that they could go any further, that they had enjoyed too much fun and they had to stop. And
we're talking booze and drugs and sex and
right.
Just exactly the sort of trinity.
Hedonism with a capital H, as one of my characters says, the location suggests promiscuity. And lots of things were happening that probably wouldn't happen today because we're much more, you know, sober and aware. But back then, as I say, we think of the 60s as the decade of the sexual revolution, but it didn't really get going until midway through the decade. And by the time the 70s hit in a locale like Key West, it was sort of at full flower, and I think that's when the real craziness began.
You've got a little bit from Tom McGuane here in that full flower, when maybe it becomes a little bit too much. And he's writing here in, which one was this? This is from his 1978 novel, Panama. It tells the story of Chet Pomeroy. It's a washed-up rock star in Key West, and you can kind of feel that tipping over into, oh boy, just too much here.
Right. I stepped out onto the patio as the city commissioner was taken to the unmarked car in handcuffs. He was in his bathrobe, and lottery tickets were blowing all over the place. Last week they picked up my dog, and it cost me a five. The phone number was on her collar, and they could have called. I knew how badly they wanted to use the gas. But then, they're tired of everything. The wind blows all winter and gets on your nerves. It just does. They have nothing but the uniforms and the hopes of using the gas. Out on the patio, I could see the horizon. The dog slept in the wedge of sun. There were no boats. The sea was flat. And from here, there was not a bit of evidence of the coordinated raids, the unmarked cars. The lottery, the Bolita, was silent. It was always silent. And behind the wooden shutters, there was as much cocaine as ever. I had a pile of scandal magazines to see what had hit friends and loved ones. There was not one boat between me and an unemphatic horizon. I was home from the field of agony, or whatever you want to call it. I was home from it. I was dead.
Tom McGuane's Panama. That's 1978. And, of course, he's got the raids and the unmarked cars. And I'm looking at headlines, you know, straight out of South Florida just the last couple of days. Two Caribbean busts, $35 million worth of cocaine, you know, thousands and thousands of pounds. That going on, maybe not at that scale, but going on at a large scale in Key West. But where's he going here? I was dead. Did it end up being a deadening place and time for Tom McGuane and others?
I think for that character, who was it was a rock star home after a fame binge. And it was kind of...
McGuane had followed that arc.
Right. It was very...
Wrecked his Porsche in Texas and all the rest.
That book was very close to the bone. It was, by the way, the first thing I ever read by Tom McGuane. I was totally baffled by it. And then when I reread it before I went to interview him in Montana, I found it hilarious. So it's kind of funny how over the years those things change. But he's alluding to some real incidents there, and that the fire chief in Key West was named Bum Farto. And he was an eccentric character to begin with. Everything he wore was red, including his boxer shorts. He just was fascinated.
Fireman right to the shorts.
And he was picked up in front of his house one day and charged with selling cocaine from the firehouse. So a lot of the power structure in Key West in those days was supplementing its income by selling mostly marijuana. I think when Bum Farto sold, if he did indeed sell the cocaine, he got in with a more dangerous crowd than the more laid-back marijuana crowd.
Let's go to our listeners. Julio is calling from Franklin, Kentucky. Julio, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. I live in Key West, Santa Cruz del Norte. Ernest Hemingway. I used to be a bartender. Ernest Hemingway used to go to the bar. Used to call Hotel Regina. I used to drink Gordon Gin all the time. It was a nice person.
And this was in Key West, Julio?
No, in Santa Cruz del Norte.
Oh, Santa Cruz del Norte in Cuba itself. So he had...
Yes.
So you met him...
I was in the 50.
Wow, after his Key West time... Was he a good customer, Hemingway?
He was a good customer. He was a nice person.
Did he tip well?
I used to go to his house in El Cotorro, too.
Julio, it sounds like you've got stories. Did he look like a happy man?
He was a happy man. Big hat, him and his wife, a little skinny lady. Used to drink a Gordon gin. The gin called Gordon. He used to drink by the bottle.
Julio, you bring it right back, straight from Cuba, right onto the table here. Gordon's Gin and Ernest Hemingway. I appreciate your call so much. Thanks for it. Let me get one more here. Bowling Green, Kentucky. Phil, you're on the air, Phil.
Hi, Tom. Nice. Enjoy the program today. Just maybe a little different perspective. I'm 58 years old.
Okay.
I was raised in Key West. My dad was a submarine sailor, and I don't know if people realize that in the 50s, up into the early 60s, to the nuclear navy, it was a submarine base. And I remember the Conks, which is a group of people in Key West of African-American Spanish descent. My godfather is a Conk. And I remember fond memories of Key West as this island, this great island place. I moved to Kentucky to go to college, asked if I ever shot a gun. I said, no, I was raised on an island, 2x3 or 3x5,
right.
And we snorkeled and did those things. So it's evolved. I think they asked whether it's been corrupt. It's evolved. I remember Key West as a military base when the submarines came in, and I think I'm right in saying this. When the nuclear navy came about, there wasn't a need for fueling stations. My mother, I'm told, is from Belgium, and she was learning to drive in Key West as a young bride and was in a little accident, forced her car up into the porch of Sloppy Joe's.
Oh, that sounds a little sloppy in itself, Phil.
Yeah, good, great point. But the other is they made the movie PT-109 there on Ramrod Island.
The JFK story, World War II story, right, made right off the Key West.
Right, out of what was called Spotswood Island, Senator Spotswood. And I had a chance as a youngster to meet Harry Truman there as he went over to Spotswood Island. I was also there during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I remember as a small child how fast the barbed wire went around the baseball fields and stuff. I just give you a perspective of Key West in the before it was quote-unquote tourist. It was just an island with a bunch of sailors and conks, and it was interesting.
Phil, I really appreciate you filling out that picture. It's got a great texture to it, but even then, really a magnet. Not for the numbers it sees now, but really a magnet. We're talking about Key West with William McKean. His book is Mile Marker Zero, The Movable Feast of Key West. Let me get one more call here. Joe in Worcester, Massachusetts. Joe, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I just wanted to say that, we have a motorhome. We travel a lot all over the place with it, and quite a few places in Florida. And I saw on a Travel Channel right after 9/11 happened and all that, we were going to go in October, and I said, let's just go to my husband. I said, let's just go to Key West. And he says, no, we have all these other plans. So we decide we're going to go there because I want to drive the coastal highway. And so we drive all the way there. We're just going to spend a day or two there. We had 3 weeks off. We ended up canceling all of our other plans and stayed there the whole time. 4 o'clock in the morning, we'd get up at noon. We'd go snorkeling or scuba diving or parasailing, any number of things. Spend out all night long and had a blast there. We actually ended up going back to St. Augustine where we have some property there. We bought some property there, and we still go back to Key West because it's just such a fantastic place to go.
Yeah, nothing like it in the country exactly, and so much history at the same time. Sounds like family history for you as well, Joe. Appreciate your call. Bill, a couple of things online here. One, a listener in Vermont says, what happens to Key West as the ocean levels rise?
You got me. All the graves are already above land. It's like New Orleans that way, and that parts of it are below sea level.
It's got very little altitude above the sea there.
I know,
not much
and that's where I'm supposed
error.
To spend eternity, exactly. So I don't know.
Maybe with the fishes. And this one, Jim writes on Facebook that you've mentioned how Key West seems to have two kinds of residents, millionaires and homeless. And he goes on, well, the same can be said about Provincetown, New York's Fire Island, San Francisco. At one time, these places were a destination that was wonderful and cheap to go to. All these places with the artists, avant-garde, large gay meccas, have been taken over by the wealthy. Hoi polloi need no longer apply unless working the back of the house. What about that? Are we losing those kind of wonderful free fringes where you could go live off cheap conch and, you know, cheap beer and pursue an artistic dream or any other kind?
I don't know that the characters I'm talking about here, Tom McGuane, Jim Harrison and Tom Corcoran, who's the novelist, who's kind of the central character through the book. I don't know if they could put together the kind of life that they had anymore. Tom Corcoran went there as a Navy officer, got out of the Navy and started selling tacos from a bicycle.
Yeah.
And, really put together a hand-to-mouth life during the 70s, all along collaborating with Jimmy Buffett, collaborating with Hunter Thompson, and then becoming this wonderful mystery novelist. I don't know how you could live like that there today. I just don't know that
it's possible.
You
think it's a shackle on the arts, or do they just bloom somewhere else in the detritus of Detroit?
I don't know where they bloom. I think Key West still has this wonderful influence. The earlier caller was right about its strategic importance as a Navy port. And I was living in South Florida on a military base during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I know that, you know, that we were in the sights. Key West and Homestead, Florida were in the sights.
And Jimmy Buffett, how do the artists look at him? He's gone off and built such an industry out of their old, you know, magic stomping grounds. Do they approve?
Well, of course, Jimmy Buffett is brother-in-law with Tom McGuane. And it's kind of funny. Here's McGuane, a very serious literary character, written all these wonderful novels. And his brother-in-law, writes a novel called Swine Knot and outsells him, you know, millions of copies. I don't think there's any resentment about that.
Well, he put the vibe together right there.
Did.
Mallory Square and all the rest. Margaritaville, built from Jimmy Buffett's time in this decade that you describe. William McKean's new book is Mile Marker Zero, The Movable Feast of Key West. There's an excerpt at our website. William McKean, thank you very much for coming in today. Wonderful sharing a little time back in that realm with those writers. Thanks for being here.
It's been fun. Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.